You are listening to a sermon by Kevin Hebert, recorded on Sunday, May 9th, 2010, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Last Sunday, Henry Neufeld gave us a lot to think about in his sermon about how to love one another. Today I'm going to pick up on one of the themes in his talk and continue to explore it, thanks to the lectionary readings containing a segue that I can use. Remember this quote from last Sunday? The most revolutionary thing about this law of love is that it sets aside the whole idea of reciprocity, the idea of equal exchange, trade-off. Jesus instructs us to go beyond the norm of equal exchange. Henry also referred to Donald Grable's book, The Upside Down Kingdom, which suggests three ways that we can express love like Christ did. One, take the initiative, make a move of compassion and love towards someone. Two, our response is not restricted to those of our own socioeconomic or religious class. Love goes beyond our friends and those to whom we should be nice. And three, love does not expect anything in return. Invite the recipient to pass along the love to others. The lectionary readings designated for today include John 14, verses 23 to 29, in which Jesus made three points to his disciples. One, if you love me, keep my words, which are in fact God's commandments. Two, don't worry, I'm going away to be with God, but he will send the Holy Spirit to remind you of my words. And third, if you love me, be glad that I'm going to be with God. I'm telling you in advance is further proof that I'm sent from him. But buried in the middle of verse 27 is a gem, a real nugget of truth that I'll focus on today. Jesus said, I do not give to you as the world gives. Why would he say that? How does the world give? Once again, recall what Henry said last Sunday. The underlying expectation in society is that favors should be returned, and returned in roughly the same value as the first one was given. We feel awkward and embarrassed if we receive gifts of a certain value and are not able to reciprocate in kind. Jesus highlighted this concept during his Sermon on the Plain, which is similar to the Sermon on the Mount from the book of Matthew. In the Amplified Bible's translation of Luke 6, verses 33 to 35, Jesus said, And if you are kind and good and do favors to and benefit those who are kind and good and do favors to and benefit you, what quality of credit and thanks is that to you? For even the preeminently sinful do the same. And if you lend money at interest to those from whom you hope to receive, what quality of credit and thanks is that to you? Even notorious sinners lend money at interest to sinners so as to recover as much again. But love your enemies and be kind and do good and lend, expecting and hoping for nothing in return. And then your reward will be great and you will be sons of the Most High. For he is kind and charitable and good to the ungrateful and the selfish and wicked. Well, as an accountant, I've always been fascinated by interest. How the rate is determined, the different ways of calculating the amounts, the different schedules for charging it, and the power of compounding, interest on interest. The vocabulary of money lending is surprisingly large and complex. A useful website for this purpose is investorwords.com, which defines interest as the fee charged by a lender to a borrower for the use of money, expressed as a percentage of the principal. The rate is dependent upon 1. The time value of money, 2. The credit risk of the borrower, and 3. The inflation rate. Well, the Old Testament contains a lot of advice about when the Israelites were permitted to charge interest or not. In Ezekiel 18, the Lord says through the prophet, in verses 8 and 9, that the person who is righteous and will surely live is one who, in compassion, does not charge interest on what he lends, who withholds his hand from iniquity, who executes true justice between man and man. In Ezekiel 22, the Lord says through the prophet in verse 12 about the city of Jerusalem, In you, men accept bribes to shed blood. You take usury and excessive interest and make unjust gain from your neighbors by extortion. Exodus 22, verse 25 says, If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. You shall not exact interest from them. A quote I found says, A bank is a place that will lend you money if you can prove that you don't need it. Attributed to Bob Hope. It would be radical to suggest that Christian lenders reassess the credit risk factor in their loan pricing and make affordability a higher principle. Both BC and Canada student loans accrue interest at prime plus 2.5%. Only in Newfoundland and Labrador is there no interest on the provincial student loans. Robert Frost is quoted as saying, "A bank is a place where they lend you an umbrella in fair weather and ask for it back when it begins to rain." But in the Old Testament, there are specific rules on the holding or seizing of collateral, called a pledge in Deuteronomy 24. "No one shall take a mill or an upper millstone in pledge, for that would be taking a life in pledge," verse 6. "When you make your neighbor a loan of any kind, you shall not go into the house to take the pledge. You shall wait outside while the person to whom you are making the loan brings the pledge out to you," verses 10 to 11. "If the person is poor, you shall not sleep in the garment given you as the pledge. You shall give the pledge back by sunset so that your neighbor may sleep in the cloak and bless you. It will be to your credit before the Lord your God," verses 12 to 13, repeated in Exodus 22, verse 25. "You shall not deprive a resident alien or an orphan of justice. You shall not take a widow's garment in pledge," verse 17. In our modern era, I think the parallel of the garment in pledge would be our shelter. Think of the heart-wrenching stories of families thrown out of their foreclosed homes, even though they have jobs, but just because they were tricked into signing a special 30-year fixed mortgage that actually had ballooning interest payments or escalating adjustable rates that have no connection to the reality of a fair return on capital to the investors. The bizarre concept of a credit default swap allows investors to buy insurance against the risk of a non-performing loan, yet the complexity and rising amounts of such insurance created the very economic instability that undermined home values and employment opportunities, which otherwise would have allowed borrowers to make their payments. Further admonishment to treat the poor fairly can be found in Leviticus 25, verses 35 to 37. "If any of your kin fall into difficulty and become dependent on you, you shall support them. Do not take interest in advance or otherwise make a profit from them, but fear your God, let them live with you. You shall not lend them your money at interest taken in advance or provide them food at a profit." In Nehemiah chapter 5, poor people were mortgaging their fields, vineyards, and homes to get grain during a famine. The prophet accused the nobles and officials, saying, "You are exacting usury from your own countrymen. I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them." Well, the definition of usury is charging an illegally high interest rate on a loan. So how much was this usuriously high interest rate that was being charged? Nehemiah continues in verse 11. "The hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil." That sounds like 1% per month, according to the commentaries that I found. So 12% per year, roughly. According to the Criminal Code of Canada, any interest rate above 60% per annum is considered criminal. In 2006, the British Columbia courts ruled in a case about paycheck advance loans that because of all the processing and deferral fees and the short-term nature of the lending, a payday loan company was charging its customers a criminal rate of interest. Since November 2009, regulations have been enforced in BC to cap the maximum charges for short-term loans at 23%, including interest and fees. Lenders are prohibited from lending more than 50% of a borrower's take-home pay or requiring repayment before the borrower's next payday. You've probably heard the quote, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be," and some people even think that's from the Bible, but it's actually Shakespeare from Hamlet. In the Bible, we find the opposite advice. God expects those with material wealth to lend it out for the benefit of the less fortunate. In Psalm 112, verse 5, "It is well with the man who deals generously and lends, who conducts his affairs with justice." Psalm 37, verses 25 to 26, "Yet I have not seen the uncompromisingly righteous forsaken or their seed begging bread. All day long they are merciful and deal graciously. they lend, and their offspring are blessed. Well, in the fall of 2008, the global financial meltdown spurred the U.S. government to create a huge troubled asset relief program called TARP, meant to encourage lending by helping American banks improve their liquidity and recapitalize. But on October 24th of that year, PNC Financial Services received $7.7 billion in TARP funds, then only hours later agreed to buy National Citicorp for $5.58 billion. There were no strings attached, and people were outraged. The last verse, 35, of that Luke 6 passage is fascinating, in which Jesus says that God is the Most High, for He is kind and charitable and good to the ungrateful and the selfish and wicked. That reminds me of Matthew 5, verse 45, in which Jesus says of the Father, He causes His Son to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. That kind of impartiality is a quality that we are expected to emulate. In the reading of Psalm 67, verse 4, Let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for you judge the peoples with equity and guide the nations upon the earth. James chapter 2 contains a warning against showing partiality towards the rich, especially harsh in verses 4 and 9, where James writes, Are you not discriminating amongst your own and becoming critics and judges with wrong motives? But if you show servile regard, that is prejudice or favoritism, for people, you commit sin and are rebuked and convicted by the law as violators and offenders. The World Policy Journal's current issue on crime and corruption examines these twin scourges around the globe. Founded in 1983, the World Policy Journal is widely cited on international relations from the World Policy Institute. Their website is worldpolicy.org. And the MIT Press. The feature article in the spring 2010 issue is entitled The Big Question: How Can Nations Break the Cycle of Crime and Corruption? It opens with a quote from Alexander Pope in his Third Epistle from Moral Essays, written in 1731, addressed to Richard Boyle, Earl of Burlington, saying, At length corruption, like a general flood, so long my watchful ministers withstood, shall deluge all, and avarice, creeping on, spread like a low-born mist and blot the sun. Well, Daniel Kaufman, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote, If not quite as apocalyptic as Pope would have us believe, corruption and crime all too often drag nations into a cycle of deprivation and wanton greed. Companies bribing bureaucrats in exchange for lucrative contracts, petty graft greasing the palms of low-level civil servants, and powerful politicians enriching themselves at the expense of their people and the advancement of society. How do nations, especially developing ones, escape this swamp? Crime rates tend to be higher where there is high unemployment, high socioeconomic inequality, and lax gun laws. Corruption thrives where civil liberties, free press, transparency, and contestable politics are absent. Even so-called legal corruption can be seen when powerful corporations capture the state. For an example outside of the financial markets, consider the case of safety inspectors deferring to Toyota over the sudden acceleration problem. Diane Francis of the National Post pointed out on March 2nd that Toyota's registered lobbyists included at least 8 former officials from the U.S. Congress and the executive branch, as well as former officials from the safety regulatory body, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Louise Shelley, director of Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center at George Mason University, wrote that countries with rich natural resources may have difficulty controlling corruption in the face of multinational businesses that are prepared to pay large bribes for lucrative contracts. One of the founding members of Transparency International, Lawrence Cockcroft, wrote a piece called Global Corruption, an Untamed Hydra, in which he explains that corruption manifests itself in many different ways, from the looting of major assets to small-scale bribery, to political and party finance, to corruption both by and within multinationals, and to the interface with organized crime. The tales of large-scale looting by the elites of many nations are sadly numerous, an accumulation of huge fortunes by a rogues gallery of heads of state. But at the other end of the spectrum, even minor acts of corruption, like small personal bribes to police or bureaucrats, can eat away at the fabric of society. In the developing world, the acute inequality in access to resources gives rise to a massive industry of small-scale corruption. And when one's very survival is predicated on a payoff, it highlights just how difficult it is to eliminate. The drivers of petty corruption, survival, greed, compulsion from above, or guanji, Chinese for connections, are substantially different from that of larger institutionalized graft. Taking of commissions by semi-skilled and skilled workers on extremely low incomes may be justified by those soliciting the bribe as a means of survival. But once the pattern is established, this can easily be regarded as a permanent source of additional income with a high upper limit. In many cases, this form of corruption is institutionalized as police officials or, say, port managers take a small daily allotment from revenues and pass a share upstream to their superiors. That was all a quote from Lawrence Cockcroft. Transparency International publishes a map called Global Graft, with pop-up bubbles highlighting upgrades and downgrades to their corruption rankings of the countries. The deforestation of tropical rainforests and industrial pollution are often permitted by officials who turn their heads in return for bribes. The high international demand for oil has increased competition for resources in politically fragile nations, where governments and individuals expect large payoffs, particularly in Central Asia and Africa. Lawrence Cockcroft recommends that an effective anti-corruption campaign be holistic and include 1. Stricter laws on campaign finance and political fundraising, 2. A strict clampdown on all forms of petty corruption generated by the delivery of public services, such as police protection, health care, and taxation, 3. A focused campaign against organized crime, 4. A root and branch reform of the procurement system that ensures transparency and a role for civil society, 5. A reform of land allocation and tenure systems, 6. The establishment of effective judicial dispute resolution, 7. The full disclosure of the value of natural resources and the terms of extraction contracts generated by the state, 8. Tougher audits of privatized companies, clarifying the role of investors, 9. The careful monitoring of banks to ensure that the flight of ill-won capital is minimized, and 10. Active participation in the repatriation of assets stolen from a country and held overseas. Admittedly, this is a tall order, even in a robust democracy, much less places that lurch between autocratic despots. Another shocking story in the World Policy Journal is from Bradley Birkenfeld, who worked at the Union Bank of Switzerland in Geneva as a private banker for high net worth clients, primarily in the United States. After learning that UBS's secret dealings with American customers violated an agreement the bank had reached with the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, he attempted to solve matters with UBS internally for approximately a year and a half. After these efforts failed, he resigned and provided the IRS with information on about 19,000 alleged tax cheats with accounts worth more than $19 billion, the largest whistleblower case of its type ever exposed. However, the U.S. Justice Department did not view Birkenfeld as having been forthcoming about his largest client, a Russian emigre and California real estate developer who was convicted of having hidden some $200 million. Though Birkenfeld voluntarily disclosed information about his client to other government agencies, which issued him a subpoena that protected him from prosecution for violating Swiss banking secrecy laws, the Department of Justice refused to issue Birkenfeld such a protective subpoena, even after repeated requests. Arrested on a single charge, he pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 40 months in a federal penitentiary, a stiffer sentence than the 30 months demanded by prosecutors. On January 8th, he entered a federal penitentiary where he wrote the following note for the World Policy Journal. So this is Bradley Birkenfeld. Though the Swiss government struck a deal with the United States to turn over approximately 4,500 names of these tax dodgers, the Swiss are now effectively backing out under the guise of a domestic court ruling, which branded this deal illegal. By taking legal action against me, the whistleblower, Washington has discouraged other whistleblowers from ever coming forward. The American taxpayers are not the only ones disadvantaged by this illegal scheme. This corruption and secrecy takes money from many government endeavors that are used to fund humanitarian projects and aid developing countries. Without tax monies from these accounts going to governments, well-intended projects may fail, and ultimately the poor and helpless will suffer. However difficult my personal situation has become, it is small compared to the cost incurred by the law-abiding American taxpayer, and the cost goes far beyond the billions of dollars lost in the mishandling of the UBS case by the Department of Justice. That was Bradley Birkenfeld. I found an interesting paper entitled Integrating Faith and Learning, Revisited, A Cosmic Perspective, by Don Roy, the Associate Director of Curriculum in the Australian Adventist School System. He articulates a model that puts faith at the intersection of knowledge, worship, and service. And he suggests for Christian students that by the time they leave school, they will have freely internalized biblical values and a view of knowledge, life, and destiny that is Christ-centered and service-oriented. But most appropriately for this topic, I want to quote Dr. Roy as saying that, "In a world of need and inequality, we demonstrate our love for God and others in the way we use the resources in our possession and control. God's kingdom is characterized by order, respect, unselfishness, and unconditional loving action towards our fellow humans." Remember what Jesus said in John 14, verse 27. "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not let them be afraid."